Hi, everyone. Welcome to Podcast UFO. I'm Martin Willis, your host, with episode number 8. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/podcastUFO. You can listen to us through Stitcher on your smartphone. We have a free app available on our website. You can listen to us on iTunes, and please feel free to leave us a review. Today's guest is Mac Maloney. He's an author in Newburyport, Massachusetts, and he wrote a wonderful book titled UFOs in Wartime. It's a great interview, and enjoy the show. Hi, everyone. I'm in Newburyport, Massachusetts with Mac Maloney. How you doing, Mac?
I'm doing very good.
Yes, thanks for joining me. And this is actually my first live one-on-one recording that's not on Skype or on the phone. And in the beautiful town of Newburyport, how long have you lived here?
Well, I lived here for about 10 years as a youth and then moved to upstate New York. And then we've been back here probably about 15 years now.
Yeah.
My father grew up here, though, so a lot of our family is here.
Yeah, nice historic town. I love history, and, you know, it's very seldom that history really gets too much involved in the UFO phenomenon. But your book, let's talk about your latest book. It's called UFOs in Wartime. And I appreciate you sending that to me. It was a great book. It was a great read. I really enjoyed it a lot. So let's talk what got you involved. And you've written, 40 books or so in the past?
Just about 40 books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what made you decide to write this book on UFOs?
Well, I was at lunch with my editor about 3 years ago, and we were just spitballing ideas, as they say. And I had mentioned to him that when I was growing up, I used to read a lot of UFO books. And my father was a World War II veteran, and he was really big into military history. So we had a lot of military history books around the house, too. And I used to read them, too. So somewhere along the lines, these two things just kind of crossed paths. And I had remember thinking quite a while ago that it seems like UFOs show up more during wartime than mm-hmm. when we're not at war. Mm-hmm. Just mentioned it to the editor, and he said, you know, that might make an interesting book, but it would have to be a nonfiction book. Would you be interested in doing that? So, you know, just thought about it for a while and finally said yes. And that was about 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the book came out last December.
I figured you must have had to do a lot of research to make something like this work. So what was involved in all the research you did for that?
It was a lot of research. It was more research than I ever thought
really
it would be. I had a lot of UFO books around the house anyway. And so then the first thing I did as soon as I knew we were going to do the book was I went out and I bought every UFO book that I could get my hands on that mm-hmm. I thought would relate to the subject. And just went through my old books. And then I was able to actually talk to Air Force pilots and Navy pilots and airline pilots.
Really?
Most of them are ex-military anyway. Because the books I've written before this, they're all military novels. Mm-hmm. So I know some people in those areas. And then I was also able to talk to people who work for U.S. intelligence agencies, who I also know. And then I just kind of put it all together. And with the help of a couple other UFO authors, Jerry Clark being one of them, very famous UFO writer, and Keith Chester, mm-hmm. who's another UFO writer, and just kind of put all that together and started banging it out, you know, and
yeah.
then just lots of editing and so on, and all in all, it took about 2.5 years.
Wow, that's a long time. Did you get the old writer's block like you normally do in writing?
No.
No,
writer's block is a fallacy. There's no such thing as writer's block. The best, if you have writer's block, the best prevention for writer's block is to have a contract and have an editor on the phone saying, where's the book? The writer's block goes away immediately
yeah.
if you get it in the first place.
Yeah, that's funny. Now, I know you started out way back. Was it Roman times? Were you actually the shield thing? I remember you talking about that.
I'm actually 300 BC with Alexander the Great.
Alexander the Great, yeah.
He was conquering the known world at the time, and he was somewhere in East Persia, and he had a huge army. With lots of ground forces, but also elephants, war elephants, and a lot of cavalry.
Mm-hmm.
And he was about to ford this strategic river when these five flying shields showed up and started buzzing his troops. And it scared the elephants and the horses to the point where they would not cross the river. So that was like, that's the first story in the book. That's the one of the few stories that we came across that actually has UFOs interfering with some kind of a military campaign. Usually they're just kind of observing. But yeah, that was 300 BC. And then 300 AD, Constantine the First was about to do battle with one of his rivals right outside Rome. And whoever won the battle was going to be the next emperor of Rome. And the day before the battle, he saw a UFO that was in the shape of a cross. And his seers that traveled with his army told him that this was a sign that if his troops painted crucifixes on their shields, that they would win the battle, even though they were underdogs. So he ordered all his troops to do that. And the next day, they had the battle, and he won. And he became the emperor of Rome. And one of the first things he did was make Christianity the official religion of Rome. And so from that point, Christianity just went all over the world. So I know it sounds crazy, but there's a point, you could make a point that Christianity flourished because of a UFO sighting.
Wow. Wow. Now, where did you find the documentation for these two last stories you just said?
I don't know. Somewhere in the pile of books I have in my room or somewhere on the internet. I should have mentioned that, too, is that, you know, a lot of research or what is good about the internet is that you can Google in whatever is on your mind and you'll get something. And that something will lead you to a book, you know, to a podcast, to a radio show or something like that. I think that we got those from the book of a broadcaster from years ago. His name was, I think his name was Jack Edwards. And he was kind of like, he was an all-night radio guy. And he also wrote books on UFOs. And I believe that that's where the first source of those two stories came from.
And then you get into the scare ships. And I think that was quite a quite a name for them. I think somewhere I read that you thought there's a possibility of time travel.
Right. You know, I always used to think, and I think a lot of people just assume that UFOs are the little green men from Mars theory. But the more I researched it and the more I kind of looked into it, the more this idea that they might not be ETs at all, that they might be time travelers, just started to make more sense. There's a UFO writer named Jacques Vallée who has championed this idea, and I'm certainly not the first one to come up with it. But it just seems like many times, especially in wartime, when UFOs show up in battle, they're just observing. You know, there's cases where British bombers would be over a city at night, being shot at by anti-aircraft fire, being shot at by German night fighters, and in the midst of really horrendous battle. And a UFO would be flying 100 feet off their wing. And I just kept thinking, well, why would they do that? You know, if you have such a technology that you can build and fly these incredible machines that people were seeing, why would you? Why wouldn't you look at something like this from a distance? Why would you want to be right there? And it just occurred to me, you know what, that maybe these are time travelers from our own future coming back, just simply watching how history was being made.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty good theory. The thing, the other side of that that I think may conflict with that a little bit is that there's a lot of, you know, mundane days where people see a UFO here and there. And, you know, maybe it's a little of both. I mean, it's and then there's the talk about interdimensional and all that. And it's, you know, the bottom line is we just don't know.
We don't know. I mean, that's the we start the book off with that phrase that someone came up with years ago that makes a lot of sense. And what it is UFOs exist. We just don't know what they are yet. The story I always kind of use as far as, you know, if they're from another dimension or another time as opposed to outer space is the example of a safari. If you want a safari tomorrow, what would you do? What would happen? You would get on a plane. You would go a long way away to Africa. They would put you on a bus or a truck or something and roll you out into the Serengeti, and you'd have cameras and you'd be with other people and you'd be taking pictures of the lions eating the antelopes and so on and so forth. Now, the animals see you, But they can't comprehend, you know, what a tourist is, what a truck is, what a camera is. So they're aware of you, but they don't know what you are. So they just go on with their daily lives. Mm. Well, it would almost be the same thing with UFOs. I mean, we know they're here. We see them all the time. But maybe just like an animal in the Serengeti can't comprehend what a tourist is, we can't comprehend what a UFO is. Mm-hmm. And then if you take that one step further, there are people who go out in the Serengeti with tranquilizer guns and shoot these animals and knock them out for a period of time and study them, and then they wake up. Well, that's pretty close to, you know, what some people say they go through with abduction incidents. Yeah. So it just seems like, I think it really all comes back to whatever they are, is that they're not making any, they're not trying to be secretive about it. They're here a lot.
Right.
And I think they just observe. They don't really interfere with that daily lives. And like I said, there's 70 stories in the book of military encounters with UFOs, but I think only about 3 or 4 of them have to do with the UFOs actually doing something to affect the outcome of a military engagement. So for the most part, they're just watching.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you mentioned a number of times where, not a number of times, but a few times where someone actually engaged and fired, and which all began back with the L.A. sighting.
Right.
Back, what was that date? Was that 52 or?
In Los Angeles, it was February 24th and 5th of 1942.
42, that's right, yeah.
Right after Pearl Harbor. Los Angeles at the time, 2 million people lived there. Lots of defense plants there. And lots of military and civil defense people in the city. And back then, people thought that the Japanese were going to physically invade California.
Right, yeah.
So naval intelligence told the people in L.A. that on this particular night, they were suspecting that there was going to be a Japanese air raid. So everyone was on a heightened alert. There were a lot of anti-aircraft guns around these defense plants in L.A. And around 1:30 in the morning, sure enough, these things start showing up on radar. They were not airplanes. They were silver discs. Some were flying in chevron formations. Others were flying separately. The air raid sirens run off. They figure that at least half the people woke up, so maybe 1 million people saw these things. Mm. Lots of police, lots of reporters. We have lots of quotes from reporters who were out that night. L.A. had 7 daily newspapers at the time, so there was no shortage of reporters. They were watching these things from the roofs of the tallest buildings, a lot of times accompanied by military or police. And what they saw was, as I say, these silver discs flying over the city. The anti-aircraft batteries opened up on them and kept firing at them for 2.5 hours. People saw anti-aircraft shells hitting these things but having no effect in them. Mm. In fact, so many anti-aircraft shells were fired off, when they blow up, if they don't hit anything, shrapnel comes down and kills 6 people on the ground.
Yeah.
Did a lot of property damage. So at the ultimate point of this, whatever was going on, a photographer from the Los Angeles Times took a picture, which is in the book, of a UFO just caught in 7 or 8 searchlights with anti-aircraft fire firing at it. And if you look at the photo, it can be nothing other than a flying saucer.
Right, yeah.
The next day, the Army and the Navy disagreed on what had actually happened. The Navy wanted to say that it was just strictly war jitters, but the Army knew that this wasn't the case, and so they came up with the story that what actually was Japanese bombers disguised as airliners bombing L.A. and taking off from a secret base in Mexico, which frankly sounds like the plot to one of my other books. So no one believed that. And so what happened was the war censors then stepped in at the end of that day and just clamped down all information on what happened. And it went away. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. But, you know, the country was into other things. You know, the World War II had just started. People were kind of freaking out, didn't know what the outcome was going to be. So people more or less forgot about it. It only came back briefly when Steven Spielberg made a really bad movie called 1942, which is about this. Hmm. But the movie itself was really kind of like Animal House in airplanes. And it was like a really bad movie. And if people out there have any knowledge of this incident, it's a lot of it is from that movie. No one has ever figured out what happened. There was no official U.S. investigation done. But once again, you know, from all the people who saw it and from the photo that the Los Angeles Times had, it's really hard to argue that it was something other than a UFO, because that's what it sure looks like in the photo.
Right. Now, so then 5 more years goes by, and then Kenneth Arnold is, which I never realized the part in your book, which talks about that he was hired as a writer mm-hmm. about the incident that happened 3 days before his sighting.
Right, the Maury Island incident.
And that sounds almost, you know, like a setup or something. It just seems weird, you know, how that all entangled together.
Yep.
Can you just give a brief description on how that all happened?
Well, the Maury Island incident is probably one of the strangest UFO stories out there. And that's why we felt we had to put it in the book. Kenneth Arnold, real briefly, is the person who, he saw a number of UFOs flying over the Cascade Mountains in Washington State. This was in July of 1947. And when he was a private businessman flying alone in his own plane. When he landed, he mentioned it to some other pilots. And soon thereafter, the press got a hold of the story. And he mentioned to the press that these things looked like saucers skipping across the surface of a pond. Hmm. And the media took that quote and turned it into flying saucers. So that's how we have the term flying saucers. But what happened was 3 days before that happened, there was a man named Harold Dowell who ran a business off of Tacoma, Washington, retrieving cut down trees that had fallen into Tacoma Bay. And he would retrieve them and bring them back to the lumber companies, a lot of lumber companies in that part of the country. So he was out there one day with his son, two other workers, and his dog on this boat doing this when 5 UFOs appeared out of nowhere and were hovering right over his boat. One of them seemed to be in trouble. And the others kind of came up to it and gave it like almost like jumping a car. They gave it like an electrical charge, and the thing kind of revitalized itself. And in the process of doing that, it expelled this what they called slag, which is the byproduct of making steel. But there's no steel mills up in this part of the world. But anyway, the slag started coming down on these people in the boat. They beached the boat on Maury Island and took cover and kind of watched this whole fantastic thing going on above them. And once the disabled UFO seemed to stabilize, all the UFOs just, boom, off, they're gone in a second. They got back on the boat, got back to Tacoma. Harold Dow's son had been injured, so he brings him to the hospital. And the people, rest of the people on the boat swear they'll never talk about this incident again. The next day, a guy comes to Harold Dow's house, and he convinces him that he's an insurance salesman. He convinces him to go out to breakfast with them. And at breakfast, though, this gentleman, who was all dressed in black, so he might have been one of the first men mm-hmm. in black,
yeah.
Said to him, listen, I know what happened to you at Maury Island. He started ticking off things that only someone who was there would know and said, it's in your best interest not to talk about this to anybody. If you do, you're going to be in trouble, and there's going to be problems for your family and your job. So this kind of put a scare into Harold now, but later on that afternoon, he went and he told the story to his boss, a guy named Fred Chrisman, whose name will be important later on. And Chrisman says he went out to Maury Island, and he too saw some kind of UFOs. So together, they got in touch with an editor in Chicago of a science fiction magazine and convinced this guy to do a story on what they had seen. And the editor thought, who better to write the story than Kenneth Arnold, the guy who was responsible for the coinage of the term flying saucers. So even though Kenneth Arnold wasn't a journalist, he agrees to do the job.
Oh, see, that's the connection I didn't get before. Yeah. I got it.
This was his mm-hmm. first writing assignment and last.
Yeah.
So he flew to Tacoma. He got a hotel room. He talked to these two guys. And as they were in there talking about what had happened, he gets a phone call from a newspaper editor of the Tacoma Times. And he says, I don't know who you people are. I don't really know what you're doing, but I have someone on the other line who's telling me every single thing you're saying inside that hotel room. So right away, Kenneth Arnold and Dowell and Chrisman kind of freak out, and they scan the rooms for bugs or listening mm-hmm. devices, can't find anything. At that point, they decide they should get the military involved. At that time, Arnold had now made some contacts with the military. This was about a month and a half after his sighting. And 2 military intelligence officers flew up from California to Tacoma in a B-25 bomber and landed and joined them in the hotel room. and debriefed, let's say, the two guys, Chrisman and Harold Dow, and got a piece of the slag and then left. They went back to Tacoma Airport, which was also a military airport, had a brief conversation with the intelligence officer there, got on their plane to take off to go back to California, and within 30 minutes, both of these guys were dead. Their B-25 crashed very close to where Kenneth Arnold had his sighting. At that point, Arnold said, you know, this is getting too weird for me. He gives up his journalism career. And he calls the magazine and said, you know, I can't do this anymore. He gets in his plane to fly home, and something goes wrong with his plane, and he almost crashes. And the fact that he was such a skilled pilot probably prevented him from being killed. After that, the FBI got involved, and rumors started that it was a hoax, and then other rumors that it was actually some kind of a counterintelligence operation. We quote cables in the book from J. Edgar Hoover to his agents in Tacoma, who say that they know that Chrisman and Dow believed what they saw. They didn't believe it was a hoax. J. Edgar Hoover didn't think it was a hoax. And then no one was able to figure it out. They spoke about it later on, and so did Kenneth Arnold speak about it later on at various UFO conventions and stuff. But the interesting thing, or the very strange thing, was that years later, Fred Chrisman was called before a panel investigating the JFK assassination. Because if you know about the JFK assassination, you know that at the time of the assassination, the Dallas police arrested three hobos on the railroad track nearby. And one of them had the name of Fred Chrisman, his name and phone number on him.
That's bizarre.
It is bizarre. Yeah. No one's ever been able to figure out the connections or whatever. But as I said, it's one of the strangest stories in UFO history that we came upon.
Right, right. Now, I can't recall. I read your book. I finished it just recently. But was there any Civil War?
There was no Civil War ones. That's interesting. There's Revolutionary War ones and World War One and Two. In Korea and all the way up to present day war. But as hard as we looked, we couldn't find anything in the Civil War.
Yeah, I didn't remember
interesting.
Anything. And what about other wars in other countries, like, you know, just battles in other countries? I mean, as far as I've heard, like 20 years ago, that there's over 50,000 recorded wars, which is kind of depressing.
Mm-hmm.
So are there little, did you find any reference to, like, wars, battles between other countries where the U.S. wasn't involved?
No, we just really had to narrow it down to U.S. and UFO encounters, or, you know, when it comes to World War One, World War Two, with the British, there's some British stories in there. But, you know, were the UFOs showing up over the Bosphorus War in 1893 or something? I don't know. You know, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah. The other thing I'd like to talk about is... a lot of times you mention in your book, which is pretty typical, is that people are told not to talk about it. Now, you hear, as far as someone like researching or paying attention to UFOs and things like that, you always hear about the Foo Fighters, but no real detail other than Gordon, you know, mentioning it a few times. But there was a lot going on during those World War One and war, especially World War Two. How many reported would you have, if you had to guess how many reports in total, would you have any idea?
Well, not really, because I can guess. And I'm going to base the guess on my conversations with another writer who I was able to work with, Keith Chester, who wrote a book called Strange Company about 5 years ago. And it's really the Bible on Foo Fighters. He really did a lot of research and went down to Washington, D.C. and got right into the 8th Air Force intelligence reports and stuff. And he came upon about 1,000 reports of Foo Fighters that could be connected to Foo Fighters between the British and American bomber commands. But he also says that, estimates that maybe 10%, this represents only 10% of what was actually seen. Because at the time, the intelligence officers of the 8th Air Force and Bomber Command really dissuaded bomber crews and pilots from talking about seeing these things. Because for the first reason, one reason is they didn't want any of this Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers stuff in their intelligence reports, is what they used to refer to it as. And number two, there was a groupthink, especially among the British, that what these things were actually Nazi secret weapons.
Yeah.
And the prevailing wisdom was that, look, we don't have the time or the money or the wherewithal to go and look into exactly what all this stuff is. We have to win the war. Once we win mm-hmm. the war, we're so sure that they're German secret weapons that we'll find out what they are once we win the war. Well, the thing was that when the war was over and they went into Germany, they found no evidence that these things were German super weapons. For them to be German super weapons, they would have to, for the Germans to be making aerial vehicles with the capability that these things had.
Right.
It would have been a project on the size of the Manhattan Project. It would have been, I mean, out of this world, literally. And there was no, no huge factory found. There was no huge support apparatus that would have been needed found. No one ever came forward and said, I was flying these things. You know, in fact, the Germans said to the Americans, we thought they were your secret weapons.
Yeah.
And the Japanese said the same thing. Mm-hmm. They asked the Japanese after the war, first of all, they said, did you have any planes over Los Angeles on the night of February 24th and 25th? They said, no, they did not have the technology to, like, move a carrier close to California at that time or ever during the war. And they said, no, we have no idea what that was. And we would see these Foo Fighters, too. A lot of them actually happened in the Pacific there, too. And we thought they were American secret weapons. So no one ever figured out what they were. And I think it was what's really telling is that once the war was over, they all went away.
Yeah.
No one saw them, you know, months later or anything. So mm-hmm. once again, it's one piece of this whole big UFO puzzle that no one's ever been able to figure out.
Right, right. And then after 1947, all of a sudden, you know, they were everywhere.
Hits, right,
and a lot of people are speculating that had something to do with the nuclear arms testing, things like that.
Mm-hmm. It could very well be. There's stories in there about how UFOs show up a lot over nuclear plants.
Yes.
Not just nuclear weapons plants, but for instance, in Washington, there's a place called Hannaford Nuclear Facility where they made the first fuel for the atomic weapons. And this place, you know, had UFOs flying around it almost on a daily basis in the late 40s. Mm. There's a story in there about the aircraft carrier Franklin Delano Roosevelt that was in service for 30 years. It was the first U.S. Navy warship to have nuclear weapons on board. And this ship was virtually stocked by UFOs for 30 years. We came upon six instances where UFOs were following it, hovering over it. Lots of people saw them right up until almost its last years in service. UFOs were just showing up over this aircraft carrier on a regular basis. And mm-hmm. then, of course, we have a lot of stories about UFOs showing up over ICM bases in the 60s and 70s. So they seem mm-hmm. to be very interested in our nuclear weapons and what we're doing with them.
Right. I know right now, Stephen Bassett, are you familiar with who he is?
Mm-hmm.
He has a petition, and the White House petition about the nuclear arms, UFOs showing up over it with nuclear arms and disarming them and mm-hmm. things like that, which is quite fascinating. It kind of makes you think that, okay, they're trying to tell us something. You know?
I think they are trying to tell us something.
Yeah.
There are so many instances where we can only put, I think, 20 of them in the book, but there were dozens of them where UFOs would show up over our ICBM silos in the 60s and 70s, and even more recently now, where when the UFO would hover over the silo, either the power would go out or something would go wrong with the targeting of the ICBM or something would go wrong with the entire warhead. And sometimes when the UFO would move away, whatever went wrong would come back to life or whatever. Sometimes it wouldn't. I think that's really sending, you know, a very clear message that they know what these things are and that they have almost more control over them than we do. And very few people know about this, in the civilian population because the U.S. military has done a great job at covering all this up.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a lot of that. There were, of course, you came across a lot of articles and a lot of sightings or whatever that you could not put in the book, you know, because you just ran out of space and time, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But is there one that comes to mind that was pretty interesting that you just couldn't put in the book?
Well, I know this. I know that I wish that this isn't exactly answering the question, but I wish that we were able to do a longer chapter on the UFOs in Korea.
Hmm.
There were so many UFO reports in Korea in a really condensed kind of area of operations. Korea is about one-third the size of Texas. And all of a sudden, you had hundreds of jet fighters flying over it, hundreds of ships offshore, thousands of troops on the ground on both sides. And it's the first instance where not only do you have radars on ships and on the ground, but you have radars in the airplanes themselves. And that's the whole thing about UFOs, is seeing is one thing. Being picked up on radar is another.
Right.
If someone sees something and mm-hmm. then it's picked up on radar, you got something going there.
Yeah.
You know, there's something there. And it's just because you had all these radars flying around that that a lot of UFOs were identified visually and on radar. You could write a book. Well, someone did write a book. Dr. Richard Haynes wrote a book.
Oh, yes.
You know, UFOs in Korea. And we kind of dipped into that for the best stories. But, there were many more stories about the Korean War and UFOs that we just didn't have the time or the space to get into. But very interesting kind of era of the UFO history.
Yeah. Did you work with Richard at all, Richard Haynes at all, on any of this?
I talked to him twice on the phone. He's an interesting guy.
Yes, he is.
He was a really high up the ladder at NASA mm-hmm. in the 60s. He had a lot to do with designing the Gemini space capsule and other things. And then he became so involved in trying to find out what UFOs are that he quit NASA, and this became his life, you know. Mm-hmm. Kind of a secretive guy, nice guy. Talked to him on the phone twice, as I said, and he gave me a lot of information about what was happening in Korea. Gave me a lot of information off the record,
mm-hmm.
which I wish I could impart to you now, but I promise not to. But
yeah.
Some very scary instances he told me about that have happened in the post 9/11 world.
Mm.
And I asked him, I said, you know, You're a learned man, and I think he's a very courageous guy, because the overall problem with UFO research is that you're ridiculed if you're a scientist.
That's right.
To say, I want to study what they are. And not only are you ridiculed, you're not going to get any funding. And when you're a scientist,
that's right.
You know, your reputation and funding are the two main things mm-hmm. to keep you going. And no mm-hmm. one wants to do it, but he did.
Yeah.
You know, he did. And you know, my hat's off to him. He's one of the people out there who are really trying to find out what is going on. He's writing a book now, UFOs in Vietnam, which we touch on a little bit in our book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is a very learned man and really knew his stuff. And it was really a big thrill for me to be able to talk to him and interview him for the book.
Right, right. And I've made that point before in a past podcast that, you know, it really, a lot of it is about funding. I mean, there is mm-hmm. no funding. And I think science should really take a hard look at this, because, you know, millions of people can't be wrong that they're seeing these things.
That's right. I mean, there's up to 1,000 UFO sightings every day around the globe. There was a survey done a few years ago that 40 million Americans believe in UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, 40 million people have either saw a UFO or know someone who has seen a UFO. 80 million people believe in UFOs. And the thing is, if they can spend $10 billion on this super collider in
right.
Switzerland to
yeah.
basically see, you know, what was happening milliseconds after the Big Bang, which, you know, I'm sure will lead to great scientific discoveries, it would seem that you would want to put as much money, or at least some of that money, into figuring out what UFOs are, because if you finally figure out what they are, it's going to be one of the greatest discoveries of human history.
Absolutely.
But
we don't need to know about neutrinos all that much.
You know, they might be able to, if we figure out what UFOs are, maybe we won't have to, you know,
that's
what
right.
that stuff is. But for some reason, well, it's not for some reason, it's basically because what the U.S. government and the CIA did early in the 50s, where they had a definite program to make it so that anyone who reported a UFO, you know, airline pilots, military pilots, or just normal citizens, would basically be ridiculed.
Right.
And that, you know, is something that's still going on today. I mean, let's face it. You know, I'm going to say maybe one out of two people see UFO is probably going to keep quiet about it, because if you make a big deal out of it, half the people out there are going to think you're nuts.
That's right. And I've run into that myself. I don't know if you have, but I've run into that a few times, and that's just the way it is. And one of the things that a skeptic person would mention or say or has said to me before, I have a friend that's really a skeptic, but I really like that because we debate a lot about it. But he says to me, well, then if it's true, then how come they're not on radars? I said, well, they are on radars. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you don't see that or hear that anywhere. And, you know, it's just because someone's not looking. There's plenty of evidence out there that they've been on radars.
Oh, they're on
times.
Radar, sure. Yeah. I mean, I'll quickly tell the story of the ghost rockets of 1946, mm-hmm. where in Sweden, in 1946, in the spring of 1946, people started seeing these rockets flying over Sweden. And thousands of people saw them. Hundreds of them were spotted. Sometimes they were flying along in formation. People saw them taking turns and maneuvering and so on. And the Swedish military got so concerned about it that they actually broke their neutrality law secretly, went to the British and asked the British to send them some radar. And so the British sent them a bunch of air defense radar sets. And sure enough, these things start showing up in radar, which I was talking about earlier, like in the Korean War. If you see it, it's one thing. If it shows up in radar, it's another. If you see it and it shows up in radar, something is there. Mm. And they got, just as soon as they installed this British radar, they got 400 hits right away of these strange things. No one ever figured out what they were. They thought at first it was the Russians shooting off old German V1 buzz bombs, but that turned out not to be true. And at one point, towards the end of this this flap of these ghost rockets, a Swedish pilot actually caught up to one and flew alongside it for a while, watched it maneuver, and had a very high, it looked like it was high, had high technology in the way it was maneuvering and so on. His description at the time was secret, but later on in the 80s, two UFO researchers interviewed one of the Swedish defense ministers, and this guy gave this pilot's description of what this thing was. And if you read the description that this Swedish defense minister gave of what was seen in 1946, and you read the description of a modern-day cruise missile, it's exact.
Really?
Wow. And he said what they saw, that pilot saw that day, was a cruise missile. But who had cruise missile technology in 1946?
No one.
That's one other theme to the book, is that in several instances we came upon where people seem to see technology that's just a little bit ahead of its time. The scare ships is an instance of that. The ghost rockets is an instance of that. The ghost flyers of 1933 over the same part of Sweden is an instance of that for some reason. And it's almost like a branch of UFOs. People see something that just shouldn't be there in that time frame. Maybe 10, 15 years later, it's not such a big deal. But airships, for instance, you know, Zeppelins before Zeppelins were invented, and airplanes with eight engines before there ever were airplanes with eight engines, and a cruise missile in 1946. So once again, what's it mean? Who knows?
Yeah, it's almost like out of time, you know, just stepped back in time a little bit. The one part that I disagree in your book on, and you may have had someone say something to you before about this, is your thoughts on Roswell. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand your point, and I know there's some wackos out there that kind of almost turned everything into disinformation, and I know it was buried for 30 years before people came forward, but there's a lot of things that, to me, when the government says, you know, it was the mogul and the bodies, they say, were crash dummies, you know, which didn't come out to 5 years later. There's a couple of things that I want to point out to you that makes me think it was really something. One of them is, how could the Air Force say they captured a disc in the first place? And secondly, why would people come forth on their deathbed? There's two instances where people were on their deathbed and they decided they didn't want to die without saying what they saw. So anyway, I just want to hear your points on that.
Well, I just want to say that for a long time, I wanted to believe in Roswell. Mm-hmm. I was so into Roswell in the late 80s and 90s that at one point, some UFO organization was going to form an archaeological team, go down to the debris field, and dig it up just in a scientific way, like an archaeological dig. And I was so caught up in that idea, I volunteered to join the team.
Wow. Huh.
They never went forward with it, but I was ready to go. But I think, as you say, it was kind of buried for all those years. I read lots of UFO books as a kid, never saw anything about Roswell, and it was when Stan Friedman and a couple other people kind of brought it back to the fore. But for the basics of it, so just to answer your question, you know, why would the Air Force say that they had a crash disk? Well, this the spy balloon program that was going on nearby, which were launching these huge balloons that would drift over the Soviet Union. They had these long kites on them, kite tails on them, with acoustic devices, and they were trying to find out whether the Russians had an atomic bomb or not by picking up acoustic evidence. Right. They didn't want the Russians to know that we were doing that because at the time, even then, technically, the Russians were still our allies. But I think what happened was when the Air Force saw the debris, and they, because this was such a secret program, they couldn't say, we found the debris of a secret spy balloon program. So they said, we found a crash disk. And that was like, so they were covering something up, but it wasn't covering up the fact that a UFO had crashed. They were trying to cover up that a spy balloon had crashed. And they used the UFO angle as the cover-up point. Next to that, and this all kind of turned for me when I was watching TV one night, a UFO show, which I would, you know, watched hundreds of them during this time I was doing the research, and they just showed the debris from the famous U.S. Air Force photograph, and then they showed debris that was left over from one of these spy balloons, and somehow photoshopping or whatever, they took those pictures from the Air Force photo and they just lined them up perfectly with the debris of the of a really crashed spy balloon, and everything matched perfectly. Just mm-hmm. matched perfectly. So I said, wow, it was one of those balloons. So in my mind, that's what I thought. And then, as you said, you add into that all these fantastic stories that have come out from there since. I mean, I think the latest books say that, you know, more than 15 UFOs have crashed in the Roswell area, and that there is, you know, dozens of alien bodies, and that the military would breaking into people's homes and shooting people to shut them up. And I mean, it sounds crazy. Mm. It just sounds crazy. And I don't think you could get away with something like that in this country. Someone would talk. And why are all these UFOs crashing in Roswell? So I just think, I always use this phrase, I just think there's too many moving parts to this story. I really believe that nothing happened at Roswell. I'm not saying that they don't have a crash UFO from some other place that they have hidden somewhere, but I just don't think it happened at Roswell. I'm open to have my mind changed. Okay, mm-hmm. I would like someone to convince me that I'm wrong, but at this point, I really don't think anything happened there. As far as with the deathbed things, I don't know. I don't know about that. I know that deathbed confessions are admissible in court, so that's pretty hard evidence. But why someone would say that on their deathbed, I just don't know. Maybe it was just something that they really truly believed, and they were mistaken about it. But I've offered to go down to Roswell with anyone who wants to convince me otherwise. So if you want to go, let's go.
All right. Well, fair enough. Now, let's talk about the latest war going on. Is there anything that you're aware of as far as sightings go?
In Iraq and Afghanistan? Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, there was a number of sightings in Afghanistan during the height of the war. The book ends with the end of the 20th century, ends in a period right after the first Gulf War. But we did come upon evidence of lots of instances of troops in the field at night seeing UFOs through their night vision goggles, which is interesting. Now, this is a war where night vision goggles are everywhere.
Right, yeah.
Okay, and it seems like for whatever reasons, UFOs are spotted more easily through night vision goggles. A lot of that in Iraq. Not so much over Afghanistan that we've heard about yet. But see, the thing is that because of the way the military treats people who see UFOs, it's going to take a while for these people who are on duty now to get out, and then for the news to kind of trickle out. In fact, I'll just say that my pet project now is what I think we should do is I think that we should either petition the government or somehow talk to the force the military to give blanket amnesty to any service person who saw a UFO during their service career and was told not to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell those people nothing is going to happen to you. Come forth. Tell everyone what you saw. And just think of the tidal wave of information we would get
from
those people.
So
I think
that's
something
that
people should do.
Yeah.
Like the UFO Amnesty Project or something like that. Something like that Steve Bassett or someone could get behind and force the military into just giving amnesty to these people and let's see what they have to say let's hear about their stories. And then the other side of it is, if the military refused to do it, then we know that they're hiding something. So it's a win-win situation for us. So I hope someday that that happens.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Now, where can someone find your book, UFOs in Wartime? It's on Amazon. And actually, before I finish this question, just to let the listener know that I'll have this up on your podcast, right underneath your podcast on our website, as far as the click and buy goes. Mm-hmm. But is it in bookstores?
Yes, it's published by Penguin Books, the Berkeley Books imprint. So Penguin's the largest publisher in the world. So they're at every bookstore in the U.S. and Canada. And my publisher always reminds me to say, please patronize your local bookstore. Uh-huh. But if you can't, just go to Amazon.com, and it's very easy to order it there. MacMaloney.com is my website. There's a lot of information there, how we put the book together and other books that we've done. So actually, the best way to do it probably is to go to Amazon.com.
Yeah. And one last question. Do you ever going to write anything else about UFOs, do you think?
If you had asked me that 2 weeks ago, I probably said no. But in the 2 weeks that, you know, they have offered me a contract to do a follow-up book, so we are going to do a follow-up book.
Excellent. Okay. Well, this has been great. So this is Martin Willis with Mac Maloney, and that's it for today. Thank you.
Thank you.